cliffcentral.com. The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. As usual, you're with me, your host, Kingsley Kipuri, for the next hour. It's always such a pleasure to be able to spend time with you and chat to you. I'm not joined by my usual comrade, Greg Nicholson. He can't make it to the studio today. He's on the streets of Wits and Braamfontein, which, unless you're living under a rock, have been following and seeing the sites that have really got the nation talking. The nation stopped and went wondering, what do we do now? What's next? Where's the leadership from the universities? Where's the leadership from the students? Where's the leadership from our national leaders and what's going to happen next? So Greg is live reporting from there. Not live reporting, I'm lying. He's live covering that. And he'll be sure to send through pictures on Twitter and write stories and publish the excellent footage that he's been recording on there. So it's just me. And of course, you and your comments on Twitter at DMShowZA. And some people sending through emails on dmshowza@gmail.com. That's really great to get input on topics you'd like us to cover, feedback on topics we've already covered, and any feedback at all, whether technical or otherwise. So if you listen to a podcast, you're not happy with the sound quality or anything else, please send us through, and we're committed to really making sure that we're bringing the best quality information and best quality news to you. So please, feedback is much appreciated. And now, with no further ado, to introduce my guest, who I'm so honored and excited to be able to chat to. I'm joined in studio by Leanne Naidu, who's currently a PhD student at Wits, the School of Education. She's also an Olympic, former Olympic beach volleyball player, should I say, and also an activist who, as recently as last week, was on a boat and had an interaction, shall we say, with the Israeli military and the Israeli Navy. And I don't want to say much, Leanne, because I want you to be able to speak for yourself. Leanne, how are you?
It's a very tense time in South Africa, as your listeners know. And I actually said leaving to be on the women's boat to Gaza was hard because 2 weeks ago the student protests had already begun. So I've returned and it seems that things have escalated, captured the imagination of everyone and also bringing people out of their shells, speaking sometimes when one can get a bit scared by what you hear in terms of the comments, but at least we're talking. So it's both a scary and exciting time to be in South Africa at the moment.
You got back on Friday.
I did.
What's it like being on home soil again? How are you?
Well, it was fantastic to arrive back to comrades, friends, strangers, people who had been watching and sending solidarity and support to the women's mission, the flotilla, to try and break the illegal blockade of Gaza. So it was wonderful to arrive back to that and also to my seven-year-old. I always have thoughts of my father off and my mother off doing political things. I was born in 76. Mm. So, you know, it was a hell of a time. My father's a teacher and was very involved in student activism and also in the anti-apartheid movement. So I keep thinking, am I just repeating what my father did by not being present for me because he was present for a bigger struggle? And then I must remind myself, but I think I turned out okay. I think she's going to be okay. So Lerato always, my daughter always pushes us and asks, like, why are you with the students so much? Why aren't you around? And we have to tell her. And there's always that balance between how much you protect your children from the inequality and the injustice in the world, because they are young and they don't need that heavy burden, and how much do you actually engage them when they ask you a difficult question about what's going on or where you've been. So it was wonderful to come back. Always challenging, though.
I mean, you said so much that I want to dig into. I'd love to start with your trip to Gaza. And, I mean, we just saw the headlines, and we saw SA Olympian kidnapped in Israel. That's what we see. And, you know, there's this shock, horror, confusion. But I'd love to get the backstory. Where does this idea first come into your head? Do people contact you? Do you contact them? How did this all begin?
So there was an idea that the flotilla, freedom flotillas, have been around for a while. The ones that many people would remember, often we remember the most violent things. So there was a Turkish boat in 2010 with a couple of hundred people on board that the Israeli occupation forces intercepted, and 10 people died, many, many, over 50 people injured in that interaction, a very big show of force of Israel insisting that they were not going to let anyone send humanitarian aid. This was not an armed mission. And so there have been freedom flotillas for many years. The idea came about that it would be good, in particular because women in oppressed places, but also, every place is an oppressed place for a woman, but let's say occupied Gaza is an extreme form of that, that it would be very good to focus on the everyday resistance that women provide to keep occupied Palestine alive under very trying circumstances. And so the idea was to gather a group of women. We were actually meant to go with two boats, so a group of about 25 women, to sail peacefully, not even with humanitarian aid or money, just with a message of solidarity, hope, and hopefully peace in a very war-torn area. Then there are a number of country-based campaigns that raised funds that had various selection processes, because of course many, many women would have wanted to go themselves. But the feeling was that we didn't want to necessarily have a very big mission, that we wanted a smaller mission, which is easier to control, easier to determine what happens when you actually confront this military force.
Do a lot of people want to go? You said many women want to go. I'm surprised that there's a lot of people who
I imagine so.
Risk their own health and safety to get on a boat and sail.
Okay, maybe not many hundreds, but there were certainly, because only one boat left, it was an extreme situation where we had very committed women who were not able to attend one or to go on the on the one boat that remained. The woman who I think the most about is a woman from Turkey who was on the Turkish boat whose husband was killed and died in her arms. She was wanting to make a return
journey. The 2010 boat.
The 2010 boat. So if that isn't brave for you, this is a woman who's faced the worst of the flotilla experiences. She was willing to get back on that boat. That's how committed some people are. Yeah. People see that this injustice is 70 plus years old. It hasn't had an opportunity. We've had a reset button in 1994. Yeah. It wasn't perfect, but it allowed for some opening of space and a different kind of time, even as it feels today, as I think about what's going on at Wits and other Wits University and other campuses, it feels like we are going back in time in a way. People are very aware that the Palestinian situation is dire and has been for a long time. And so there may be not hundreds of women, but there certainly were women I had to see cry and had to wave goodbye to when we set sail from Messina in Italy.
In me questioning the number of people willing to go, I know we mean to belittle the cause. I think I'm just questioning that out of respect for how brave it is to get on this boat and face the soldiers and whatever may come head on. And I'm curious, has the Israel-Palestine cause always been something that's very personal?
It has.
Do you have any idea? If you could speak a bit about why that's so personal for you.
I grew up in the Cape Flats in Cape Town, and the Cape Town community, I mean, this has changed because of the conditions of the world, 9/11 and a whole range of other things. But the Cape Town community is always Christian, Muslim, have managed to live together, in my small experience, better than they have in recent years. Yeah. And I had a coach, in fact, by the name of Ishmael Collier. He's now passed because of cancer, but he ran my father. It's a crazy story. My father coached him when he was a coach. He then ran an Olympic 200-meter qualifying time.
Wow.
But there was boycott against South Africa and apartheid South Africa at that point, and he was offered the possibility to go. It was in the period where some in the apartheid state were allowing some window dressing. Mm. He was very clear he wasn't going to go. He then was a maths and phys ed teacher at the public high school I went to.
Wow.
He coached me. I mean, I went to the Olympics largely because of the guidance and technical skill that he was able to share with me. Mm. He was also he supported the Palestinian cause for many years. And so all our anti-apartheid understanding was always linked to this other cause for me. And also then post-apartheid, obviously there are a number of people who are still looking to that place saying it cannot be that there's an apartheid, legalized apartheid situation still existing. So for me, it's from when I've been young, I've been exposed to pro-Palestinian and anti-occupation rallies and readings and conversations. So it kind of made sense when I was called and asked if I'd like to apply. Mm. There was a fairly open process in the sense that people well, maybe not open, but people, a number of women in South Africa were asked to apply if they were willing to go on this. And then there were a couple who did, and there was a selection process. And that obviously had to do with availability, who applied, and who people, who the broader committee felt would be important to be on this journey. Yeah. I think for me, I also went through a phase, because in my upbringing, my family was so involved in the anti-apartheid movement. My father was arrested on hunger strike. We were dragged to meetings. At some point in my life, I was really angry about that. So when I went to university, to UWC in 1995, I wanted to do anything but fight against apartheid or injustice. So I played sports. So my first university experience was, I was one of those.
You were like, what's not political? Yeah. Sports, let me try that.
But of course, my political activism came through sport, because I learned my politics through sport. But what I really decided was, okay, I want to play beach volleyball.
Okay.
And volleyball, and I want to travel the world because I would never be able to afford to do that. I come from a working class family, so I want to play. I want to try and play internationally. And I mean, it's not true that I wasn't politically active in the sense of very organized things or on the student representative council. Okay. What I did do through sport was, I mean, I'm an out lesbian woman, so for me, I was using the platform to continue to talk, and in particular around women's issues and sexuality issues and struggles. And so, but I was tired and angry at that point at my parents for maybe not paying enough attention, for dragging me to too many meetings. And I see myself doing that to my own child now. But then I started getting more involved as I exited international sport. So I was in the 2004 Olympic Games. We tried at the Olympics in our technical briefing to challenge some of the sexist rules around the size of one's bikini not being on the side larger than 5 centimeters. This is the way that the corporatization and the sexism of a very sexy sport, beach volleyball, was imposed on us. And so we tried to, in a small way, resist this and try to critique it. I then played for another 2 years and was very close to qualifying for Beijing when I decided that this was actually not the terrain where I could change the world or fight against injustice, because it was so tied up in a kind of corporate, the worst kind of internationalists understanding, people playing for their home countries but living in another place because they want to get away from their home countries, as opposed to an opportunity to meet different people and hear about what's going on in the world. So when I retired from international sport, I trained as a teacher at UWC. So I wanted to go back into education, and I did some sport education things, and I learned about the CETA system, Sector Education Authority. I did some sport education, and then I landed up at WITS. And at WITS, my partner's an academic there, and they needed someone to help organize a critical theory program. I then started, kind of haphazardly it worked out. I never studied project management, but I studied organizing. I can organize things.
There we go.
I helped organize myself to get to the Olympics, because our national federation didn't fund us as well as they should. Isn't that the story of most Olympic sports? But then getting into a university context where critical theory was being discussed.
What is critical theory?
So critical theory, many people have different understandings of it, but my understanding
is... My working definition
is, what are the critical questions of our time?
Okay.
And where do we go to try and figure out these difficult questions? And that's really broad.
It's right? broad so enough it broad. To accommodate different...
So for me, I was with academics who were... We were running an annual summer school program for PhD students and staff, academic staff, around a broad question. So 10 days of conversation, and trying to also rethink what critical conversation is inside of the university, and trying not to be bound by the university rules around you have a professor, the professor professes to you, and then you become more enlightened.
Like the professors.
Right. So... anyway, that was a hell of a learning experience, and I did start to both be drawn into the university as well as remain critical of it. I did a part-time master's as a result, because I was staff. I could go and do a part-time master's in education. And there I was really interested in, I went to the 80th birthday party of an educationalist called Anne Hope. She's now passed last year. And she told the story of how in 1972, she was approached by the South African student organization, the Black Consciousness Movement, because she'd worked and studied with Paulo Freire. And people had been reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed under the table because it was banned at that time. She was then approached by Steve Biko, Bonnie Pityana, Johnny Issel, Mampela Rampele, and others to train the SASO leadership in radical pedagogies, in Paulo Freirean methods, in this idea of Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And she then, for a week at a time, for 6 months, met the top national leadership of the South African student organization. Not teaching them in Freirean spirit,
not professing,
engaging with them around how to develop a literacy campaign.
I mean, so, these are a lot of the Black consciousness leaders that we look to now.
And they were students at the time.
And Revere now and Quote now. And
so when I heard that,
she had
an
opportunity,
like,
to work with them.
Why have we not heard more about that process? I mean, we all know that those students were doing much more than just being university students, and they were really connected to community. So they went to a white liberal in the Black consciousness sense. In 1972, so Biko's already written the critique of white liberals.
Yeah.
They went to her and they said, we need you to help us with this. And they were in a process, and I wanted to look more closely at that process. So that was my master's research. So I look at the role of radical pedagogy and education in the formation of the South African student organization. And then I do well at that, surprisingly to myself, and I get a scholarship, government scholarship, to do a PhD also in education. I originally want to look at, because of my critique of universities and even the schooling system, I want to look at the idea of teachers as intellectuals rather than functionaries of a curriculum, be it your own curriculum at the university or a government curriculum in a high school. And I was in Cape Town when the Rhodes Must Fall happened, and when it did happen, I immediately went to UCT, and when I sat there with those young people, I'm also young, but they're younger than me, I got a sense that this was a really important moment. I got on the phone with my supervisor and I said, I've already collected some data with teachers who taught under apartheid, but I think this question of who is an intellectual is a really important one, and I think it's an even harder one to engage when you think about students who haven't qualified anything yet. They're undergraduates, some of them. And here they are asking critical questions about the state of university and, in fact, about the state of society. So this is how I end up being a PhD student now, and this is how I end up in the middle of Fees Must Fall, because I'm studying the Rhodes Must Fall movement and looking at students, Black students, as intellectuals and the role that they play in questioning society, etc. So I land myself kind of haphazardly in the middle of what's going on at the moment. And I think as a result of that, and also because students have insisted that professing is not the only answer, that we need more creative ways of understanding education, especially coming from this place that is much more historically around the oral and around people doing things collectively, that we need to rethink what universities and education is for. And so I then get started. As with other students, we get asked to be on panels and give lectures and things that would have been impossible to imagine 2 years ago. But academics understand that actually maybe these youngsters have something.
They've got something to say.
Yeah. So because of that, I think there is then a trajectory from a sports profile into a more activist profile, into a kind of a critical, engaged citizen. And I think that's why they selected me to go. And I'm eternally grateful, even as I'm still trying to recover from the trip, eternally grateful for the opportunity to represent South Africa in a different way, but also to sit in conversation and through struggle, because that boat was a struggle for me. I mean, I like to have my feet on the ground and to be.
How long were you on the boat?
We were on the boat for 9 days.
What is that experience like for you?
For me,
physically and emotionally.
So physically and emotionally, besides even the interception and the prison and the whole Israeli thing, for me, that was, I mean, it was in some ways harder than the Olympics, because there's a way that you can, when you find something you enjoy and you become a bit of a specialist or expert in it, you really enjoy it, you can push yourself to particular limits in relation to that thing, and you can engage the emotional, the psychological. I mean, you have that opportunity in anything you do, art, sport, music, whatever you want to do. And so getting on the boat for me was, I don't like to be out of control in that way. I deal with stress by actively, I'm an activist, by actively being involved and then obviously thinking about it and reflecting on it. In this situation, I was at the mercy of, I know that's a strong phrase to use, but it felt like I was at the mercy of a captain and two very young crew members, and the sea and the weather and this very small, not very fancy boat for a very long time, leading up to what was meant to be a very and going to be quite a difficult situation.
And an unknown sort of eventuality.
So, unknown. I mean, I got, I think what was my first real panic attack on the second day. So we were all fairly seasick for the first 3 days. Anyone who sailed knows that a yacht is very rocky. And apparently, only to find out afterwards from the captain, the Mediterranean is understood as this beautiful flat place. But because it's mostly landlocked, the waves are very choppy because there's no, it's not like when you're in the ocean, you have these long waves.
Oh, I understand.
So you are rocking all the time. So people were really sick. And we had some women on the boat who were over 70, and some of them were really struggling. Well, one was really struggling. The other one was better than all of us. So maybe that's not a fear. The age issue is not necessarily the issue. But it was challenging because on the second day, I woke up in the dark to a loud bang with the captain jumping from the dead of sleep, running outside in our underwear because something in our rigging had snapped in a little squall storm. A wire suspension had literally snapped. And when I looked outside, there were sheets of rain in the darkness with the crew screaming at one another outside on this boat. And I was just, for the first time in my life, I'm actually glad I don't have to go out there. She said, go back to your rooms, everyone, because we were all standing there like petrified.
I guess we should help. But you
I
don't,
went
you
back
know.
To my room and I sat there and I was like, okay, yeah, I really need to trust that either we're going to die in this situation, I don't know what's going on, and knowing is not going to actually make it better. I'm just going to sit here. And I really had to breathe and think and try to calm myself down in that moment. So there were many moments on that trip that were difficult and difficult and expanding in interesting ways.
How do you center yourself in a situation like that? What if you can remember, what was the thing that you came back to? Was it perhaps the purpose for the trip? Is it something else?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I kept the entire time, because we knew where we were going and we knew that the potential was high that we wouldn't get there, I kept taking things back to the Palestinian woman that we were doing this in solidarity with. And so in that moment, I was like, this is frightful, but in an occupied space where you are bombed regularly and you have checkpoints, this is okay. You know, we're in the sea, we have life jackets, we have a trained crew, I can swim. Okay, a lot of people know that we're out here.
And you chose to be there. If nothing else, this is voluntary.
And
right?
So the kind of physical thing that I, besides choking down some rescue remedy, I try to just center my breathing. That's something post-sport that I've been engaging with through, you know, just being in difficult situations and trying to center myself. So, the situation also normalized after about an hour and a half where they figured out what was going on. At the moment, the conversations with students around how they deal with the trauma that they're dealing with, many people do different kinds of things. But when you're in a boat, on a boat, in the middle of nowhere, in the dark, in the rain, with something broken, you can't go anywhere. So that's what amplified the situation for me. And that was true for the full 9 days. There were two or three other occasions, I won't bore your listeners, but where I was like, I was really like, what am I doing? I really had to breathe and remind myself. The other interesting thing was that because it was a 9-day journey and we had 1,000 nautical miles to do, no matter how sick or scared we felt, if one person had to lose it and go like, I can't, it would have jeopardized the entire thing because there was no way to helicopter someone off. It would mean we'd have to take this entire mission. And that was a hell of a stress for everyone. I was quite clear. I can be quite stubborn. Harakat, as they would call it in Cape Town, where there was no way I was going to come back. Like, if there was going to be a shark and we were sinking, that's my worst nightmare. I would be there. I wasn't going to say, bring us home. That would have just been the worst possible. That would have been worse than sinking. The idea of committing to this thing.
We decided to turn around.
No, because we were getting satellite messages from Gaza from women and children who were waiting. People were on the beach when we were supposed to arrive. Not hundreds, thousands of people. Jeez. We were, So there were many moments on that boat that pushed us. I mean, some of the most fantastic moments for me were the conversations with the other woman on board. Everyone on that that boat is an activist, is engaged in their context, but also seeking out solidarity efforts. And I think there's a big lesson in that for all of us. I mean, we can get so tied up in our own little problems. Everyone's got challenges regardless of race, class, gender. But if we don't look up from that to see where, how would one put this, where the most extreme forms of oppression exist in our society and in the world, we can actually miss a lot of what reality is. We can get caught up in our own stuff. And so the women on that boat were involved in intense struggles we had a member of parliament from Algeria and New Zealand, a Maori woman from New Zealand, a member of parliament who had to flee Chile in the 70s and was now a member of parliament in Sweden. We had our kind of team leader is a 70-year-old retired lieutenant general from the U.S. Army, like a really high up army person who around the Iraq war said, I'm not going to do this. And now is a peace activist. Mairead Maguire, who is a Nobel laureate, who lost family in the Northern Ireland struggles that have been happening. So just amazing, amazing people, women, willing to do this thing. I mean, two people on the boat couldn't even swim. I don't know if I would consider doing a mission like that's how
committed
people are, not only to their own struggles, but to solidarity. So, I mean, I felt like it was a moving classroom for me, you know, in a very interesting way.
Okay. I just want to quickly play the audio of the sort of recording that you sent back.
My name is Leanne Naidu from South Africa. If you're seeing this video, we've been intercepted and kidnapped by the Israeli occupation forces. I want to put an appeal to all my comrades, brothers, sisters, family in South Africa to put pressure on the South African government to insist that they release me as soon as possible. I mean, that was recorded the day before we left, because the flotilla movement has experience of different kinds of interceptions. And also, I mean, one of the things that was interesting, besides the kind of absolute military might of the Israeli occupation forces, there's also a very well-oiled repressive machinery around communication. And so we understood that if we were going to be intercepted, we were going to go offline. They were going to intercept everything.
Yeah.
They were going to stop our satellite transmissions. Mm. They were going to take away our phones, our cameras, anything that could record and communicate, even after the fact. What we had gone through was not going to be with us. And so it was under that context that we realized we needed to pre-record something and leave that in the safety of our lawyers and other people's hands for the moment that we were intercepted. So, I mean, it's weird to listen to it now because the moment that I recorded it, we hadn't even set foot on the boat yet. So my voice even sounds kind of not distressed like, in a way. Even though the message is distressing, it was when I was recording it, I had no experience of why it was so necessary, and I was really glad that I did in the moment that, you know, before we reached the 100-mile from Gaza mark on the Wednesday morning around 6 a.m. sunrise. And that meant that 100 nautical miles in our boat takes about 20 hours.
Okay.
So it's close, but it's not super close. I mean, by mid-morning, they'd cut off everything. We hadn't even seen any naval ships or anything, and we were realizing actually they've jammed us. The Al Jazeera people who'd been reporting live and sending package feeds every day were like, no, there's something going on here. We've been, it's been intercepted. And we were confident, we became more and more confident as we were counting down these miles. We were even below 50 miles, we were like, oh, maybe we're going to make it. Maybe they're just cutting off our communication, but they're actually going to let us go through. And then you see something on the horizon, and the captain takes the binoculars and looks, and okay, they are here. We are a 15-meter long yacht with 13 people on board. We see a naval vessel. And then another one flanking us on either side, and then one behind us, quite far away. Right. So, I mean, if you didn't want to see it, you could say, no, it's not there. I'm not seeing it. But, of course, we were all very interested. And then the radio starts going. And because we were very clear that we were going to be a peaceful mission, we were not going to confront other than saying that we're going to Gaza. We were not going to be confrontational because from previous stories, very small confrontations can explode, partly because people are so the Israeli soldiers are so fearful of us and of people that have been painted as terrorists. Anyone who critiques Israel is problematic and needs to be restrained, in their training. And many of them, the average age was like 20, 21. It was quite shocking to me that this was the age of the soldiers who eventually boarded us. So, you know, we got close to like 40 nautical miles, and this radio conversation now starts going between, in the end, there were three people from the Israeli occupation forces. As we reached the level of frustrating the one, then a more senior person came and a more senior person. Our captain.
So what is the conversation? You say you're frustrating them. Are they asking you to turn around? Are they asking your business?
The conversation is Zaytuna, Zaytuna, come in.
Which is the name of your book?
Zaytuna Olivia. Yeah. Zaytuna means olive in Arabic. We would like to inform you, I mean, these are not the exact words, but we'd like to inform you that you are entering a security zone, which was not true because we were in international waters.
Okay.
And we know this because we've talked about
it. It's the self-declared security zone.
Yeah, it's the self-declared. You are on a course to an area that is restricted. We appeal to you to please alter your course to XYZ. And then, of course, our captain goes, thank you so much for your communication, but we are on a course to Gaza to take a message of peace and solidarity and hope to the women especially and also children of occupied Gaza. And it goes back and forth like this. What we would recommend is that you drive your boat straight to Ashdod Port. Usher you to the port.
So there are naval boats on either side, basically.
Basically, we'll take you in, but you can drive your own boat. We won't even get on board, to which we're like, no, we're not
doing that.
That
sounds generous.
Then they're like, or you can get onto our boats and we can drive you much quickly.
Even more generous, yes. We'll give you a lift.
It's interesting you say generous because one of the experiences that I didn't expect, I expected to feel affronted by the military might, which I was, because they released these Zodiac boats that look like something from Star Wars. They're a little bit smaller than our yacht, but they have 16 soldiers on board. They have all these tiered seats like in a stadium, guns, lasers, and they come at you fast. They're like rubber ducky, like advanced rubber duckies. So those two come at us, and you know immediately, there's nothing we can do here. We can't outrun you. We don't want to outrun you. We don't want to engage you in this way. So you do have that brute military force that sets up the more than David and Goliath situation in Israel-Palestine. But the thing, the so-called generosity of this brutal system is what was the most harrowing for me. So the generosity of giving you all these options to not do what you are coming to do. One of the hardest moments for me was when we were boarded by four women soldiers and four men soldiers. we were all sitting above deck because we didn't want to scare them and be underneath or in different places. So we were on deck. They could clearly see we were not going to challenge them. A very young sailor soldier went and stood with our captain, and they managed to figure out how they were going to steer. And then what happens is you see the Zodiac come storming towards you again, and now they're starting to pass things, and they're passing water, and they're passing what looks like a picnic. You know these cooler boxes with the zip?
Yes.
I'm like, what's going on here? And we had agreed that only our captain and our team leader would speak.
Okay.
That we would be peaceful and silent, which is obviously very hard for a number of the women on board because these are outspoken activists. What then happens is that the water gets offered to people, and you've been sitting now in the blazing sun. So someone takes a bottle of water, and then the picnic basket comes with chocolate mousse and hummus and a whole lot of things. And then one of the sailors, who's a young woman who supports the cause but is not necessarily an activist, starts making herself a... And at that moment I say, listen, I don't eat Israelis' goods at home. I support BDS. I'm not about to eat your food. And then I'm quiet again because I could not. The generosity, that kind of generosity is a fake generosity. So that was the first moment of generosity in inverted commas. That I experienced then, but when we got into the port and even into the prison system, there is again that fake generosity that I'm sure is not afforded to everyone in the same way, because certainly we are high profile and a lot of people were watching what was happening. But even so, the generosity that was afforded us, it's not confusing as much as it is maybe disgusting. I don't know how to explain it to you. So when we arrive at this port, it's midnight. We've been on the boat for 7 hours with these soldiers. We are unable to move or to do what we want. They've searched all our bags. So that is not about a gun, but it is about the thing we know in South Africa very well, the restriction of freedom, of movement, of the ability to speak about what you're going through, of the ability to share what you're going through images and other kinds of whatever's allowed technologically now. So many people have asked, so did they treat you well? Were they screaming at you? No, they were not screaming at us. So if you were to take that out of context,
on the surface,
you were treated well.
Yeah, it was great. We had a picnic. That was great. But
so a similar thing can be said about the experience of being processed through the firstly Navy, then handed over to the military with the police there, as well as the what do you call them, immigration police and system. And the thing that they, I know we don't have a lot of time, but the searching of your bags continually, the strip searching of your person continually, even though in very like kind ways, like please stand here, please do this. The what starts out as an interview, but then you very quickly realize this is a form of interrogation and manipulation to try and get us to sign a deportation order immediately so that we can be taken out of the country. That for me, that was more violent in a way, and it reminds me, even as everyone is shouting about the student violence and the police retaliation, kliphooi, rubber bullets, whatever, what we often forget is that universities are violent places for black poor bodies and people. South Africa is a violent place, not only physically, politically, economically, socially. There are all these forms of violence that one can easily just coat over to hierarchize violence against person, which is terrible, violence against property, which is also in some ways terrible, over the kind of daily mundane. So I really got a sense that even as we were being treated well, the affront of continually being so... I got strip searched in the space of 36 hours 3 times. I had to put my bag through metal detectors, have people pull my panties and everything out in front of people 4 times. Every time you arrive at a different arm of the state, they want to recheck you, and they do this. And that is part of the dehumanization. The fact that you are continually stopped from existing in a way that you want to, but then also you continually get treated in a manner that's on the one hand kind with kind words, and on the other hand just like inhumane. So that was surprising for me because I thought it was going to be more that the people were going to be there with guns and going to shout it.
Yeah, literal.
And I was almost more prepared for that. So the another moment that was really revealing for me was, besides some of the women not being able to swim, two of the women, Dr. Fauzia from Malaysia and the Member of Parliament, Samira from Algeria, both do not have consular representation or diplomatic ties with Israel. So that means they go there knowing that their government can't help them.
Will not help or try to negotiate.
Right? So I go there knowing that we have representation, but we have a critical, at least policy stance towards Israel.
In theory.
Yeah, in theory. But my assumption is that my government will be there. There's a moment on the second day. So we arrive at the prison at like 2 in the morning and we process throughout the night. There's another form of like confusing you is that I think I slept. I thought going to prison, I'm going to be able to sleep a little bit properly without everything going up and down. No, they wake you up. I saw a social worker. They bring you back. 2 medical doctors. They bring you back. And so it is again this thing of, but we're checking your blood pressure. Mm. We're asking you questions about your family as a social worker. Like, no, why are you doing this to me? Why am I in prison? Yeah. I didn't want to come here. Don't give me a doctor. Give me my fucking phone call, which they never did. They kept telling us, I mean, and this from watching the movies and knowing law, everybody gets a phone call. No matter how bad you are, no matter how righteous you think you're being, you get a fucking phone call. Yeah. They didn't give us a phone call. So my family didn't hear from me. And then, so we go through the night of being woken up and taken to different places, fingerprinted, you name it, photographed. And then the consular representatives start coming. And so one by one, people get, the Spanish photographer gets called to go and meet her ambassador, the American, the New Zealander, the Chilean ambassador, for someone who is not even in Chile anymore, comes with the Swedish, the Norwegian. Yeah. They're all there. Samira, myself, Dr. Fauzia. Samira and Dr. Fauzia are the only two in full hijabs. We don't go anywhere because our representative, they don't have one. We have one in theory who hasn't pitched up. We eventually get to a point where we can now speak to our lawyers, the Israeli lawyers who work with Gabby Lasky, who's helped with flotilla missions before. We then get taken to the open area where the consular people come. There are 2 picnic benches there, and we see our fellow comrades participants sitting at the benches with their consular representatives. Don't they take the Algerian, the South African, and the Malaysian, past the benches, open up a what is an outdoor cell so we can see everybody doing their thing, but we are locked up in that cell. And we're going, but we with them, those ones that are sitting there. Why are you locking us up? Just keep quiet and wait.
In view of them,
In view of them. And so I say to my comrades, especially Samira from Algeria, she says something very poignant at that moment. She says, at least we are in Palestine, in the sense that we are in Palestine and we are in the position that Palestinians are in, or how they are treated kind of more explicitly, because it was clear that it was the brown people, the Muslim people, the Africans who were being locked up while the Spanish and the Americans and the New Zealanders and the Australians were able to sit outside. Yeah. So there's all these, and okay, someone can say, listen, you misreading, you overreading, maybe. But look, when we questioned, we even asked our lawyers, can they not let us out? The lawyers asked them and they're like, no. So someone makes a decision, someone wearing a badge over you in a manner that is seems to be fairly unfair and inhumane. And of course, nothing compared to what Palestinians go through. So, I mean, I'm reflecting this to try and open up some of the questions around mobility, around dehumanization, around what happens when you separate people out in the way that they have over the Israel apartheid. So it was really surprising to me to not have representation. I mean, they even took us in front of a judge. They woke us up for the last time before they moved us to the next detention center. which was at the airport. They took us to a judge where we had this hearing, what was a bail hearing, to see whether they would release us into Israel. We'd never wanted to go to Israel, so I wasn't too sad that they turned down the bail application. But, I mean, it was 36 hours of processing, strip searching, some relief to be on land.
And then
just, like, frustration around not being able to phone people. And also not knowing, because you never know exactly what's going on. And there was continual pressure to get us to sign so that they could get rid of us quicker. Lots of pressure around saying, we have a holiday coming up in 4 days. If you don't sign that thing, you're going to stay for 10 days. So we had to have discussions about what more can we do. We'd resisted signing and leaving immediately. They'd had to process us, therefore, as illegal. So we made the decision that actually we'd all sign together. We made them change the document to ensure that everyone got sent home to where they wanted to go, as opposed to just dropped in Istanbul or somewhere.
To where they decided.
Yeah, exactly. So once we decided that, things became... I started seeing the light, like, actually we're going to be out of the situation. Yeah. My flight was delayed for an hour, so I had to sit after the last strip searches and searches of our baggage. I had to sit in a police van thing for about an hour, locked up. And in that moment, the guy who was driving me, we had a short engagement about Israel and Palestine and what was happening, and we at the end of it agreed that the military and arms was not the way to figure out a peaceful solution. So this was even from an Israeli.
Wow.
I mean, the opinions differ, obviously, but even on the boat, at least one or two of the soldiers made the point that they're just doing their job. You got a sense that, I mean, they are a people who forced their, like the apartheid government did, forced their young men and women into an army that is overseeing an occupation, which means a very violent situation, racist situation. And that must seriously do some damage to some young people out there.
I can imagine. I'm so glad you're here. I'm glad you're back home.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, knee-deep into the FISMA's fall situation.
Wow.
I mean, we've only got about 10 minutes, but I'd love to dig into some of your thoughts on that. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you gave the Ruth First lecture, I think it was about 6 weeks ago, sometime in August.
Yeah.
And you had such potent sort of comments and insight into the situation we find ourselves in.
Yeah.
And they're just about two insights that I'd love to touch on. The first is you describe a disconnect between the student activists now and the anti-apartheid activists of sort of prior generations, the older activists. Mm. And this disconnect is one where students have been very clear that the status quo is not acceptable, that we need a different reality. And you've got older activists who are saying, We fought for liberation. We've achieved liberation. We are free. We have democracy. A black person can stand up and go to the shops without showing a dompas. I can buy property if I want. And this sort of disconnect, and the, another reason why the disconnect is so important is because the older generation have a lot more structural power in terms of political power and so on.
And a lot more to lose.
So I'm curious as to, What do you think bridges this divide? What is that thing, or who is that person, or what is that conversation that enables that divide to be bridged in some way?
Yo, if I could answer that question, we would save so much heartache.
We wouldn't be wasting time here.
No,
we'd
but
be
let me
there,
try.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's a good question. For me, some people would say there's no bridges. We actually can't.
Okay.
The bridges that we've seen built in 1994 have been bridges to places we never agree to go. So I don't know if the metaphor of the bridge works. For me, it isn't a person. It has to be a process, and it's not a one-off process. This is one thing we've learned, and what
it's
I've
said... It's not the Imbizo from last
no,
week.
No, and it's not also one transitional moment where we've arrived. We don't arrive. We never arrive. And that was something of the conversation I was having with other people on the boat, was that, yes, we are post-apartheid, but... somehow we rested on our laurels a bit too much. And that was partly because people were demobilized and partly because people were tired. I think there's a whole range of reasons, and we have to do more critical thinking and engagement around that transitional moment. But I think it is a process, and it also, what students have brought to the table is that the forms of representative democracy that we imagined were our savior, then it's not. And so many communities and the student movement, with all its flaws, have been experimenting with a more participatory form of democracy. Mm. That, for me, points us in a particular direction that I would follow rather than simply, like our Minister of Higher Education, our President, and others have been saying, we have fought for this vote and this system, and if you don't fit in here and you are not elected, then you are illegitimate and we don't listen to you. And that, for me, is freezing us in a moment that doesn't allow us to think creatively. And that's what I was trying to say in the lecture, that we actually, we are misreading the time and the idea that liberation is here, that even democracy is here, has to be up for question.
And you describe that as a fantasy or an illusion that perhaps we need to do away with. Not perhaps, that we need to do away with.
We need to be more critical. Yeah. And the thing is that it also seems to me, and people might think this is unrelated, but it seems to me very related, that we have a number of traumatized, fearful people. Young people now, we're doing the same thing to our young people that was done in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. We're doing the same thing to them now. But when I look at the older generation, even those who have the experience of struggle, who are critical, who are social scientists even, it seems to me that they are fearful and potentially fearful of having to go back to that traumatic moment.
Of losing perhaps what they...
Losing what they've got. But I mean, I would imagine that anyone in the South African context would recognize that the status quo is a terrible one, and that wouldn't want to make... I mean, okay, no. I've heard a number of people, trolls, who are very happy with the status quo, who are even calling for the police to use live ammunition, if
wonderful.
You can imagine it.
Thank you, so, these 24 commenters. Yeah, we appreciate it.
Let me not be over. So the status quo is a mess up. It is true that there is an acknowledgement and a recognition for people who faced down apartheid police, who organized under difficult circumstances,
who lived in exile,
who went into armed forces, all of those things. But that's not the end of the story. And we really need, what I was getting to and I got distracted, was that we have very vulnerable masculinities that are at the helm of a whole range of institutions, from the military to our government, to our universities, to our student movements. They are everywhere. And the women's voices, queer people's voices, poor people's voices have been, I mean, if you think about it, the intersectional debates that Rhodes Must Fall and others in the Fees Must Fall movement, or at least in the decolonial student movement, have been trying to engage, trying to bring a different kind of revolutionary actor and actors into the fore. That has been missing from this last iteration, at least in the Wit situation. And for me, that's problematic. We really do need different kinds of voices. And we also need to deal with the fact that we have people who are fearful not only to lose their material things, which is, I mean, we know that people don't want to give up privilege because everyone wants to be comfortable. But further than that, people are really scared of unleashing the kind of pent-up law and order through policing have managed to maintain the divides. So the apartheid laws are gone, but we have these very strict divides. We have the middle-class democratic South Africa, and we have township life. And it's not that simple. I mean, we have a short amount of time.
You've got about 3 minutes.
But the point is, we cannot continue in this way.
Okay.
And students have said, we are prepared to say that we're not going to allow this to happen. I think we need the older generation, and I've been seeing more and more of the older generation, especially as these scenes that are reminiscent of the 80s and the 70s flash on people into people's minds. They are going, oh no, this is not how we want to go ahead. So for me, I'm hopeful.
It's encouraging.
It's not a bridge, but it is potential for dialogue. And we really need to, I mean, our president has just announced a task team that has three ministers from the security cluster on it. If that isn't an indication of the way government wants to solve problems and that we're on the wrong road, I don't know what is. The processes of task teams and commissions led by government, they don't work. We need participatory democracy. We need to listen to people, to students, to the average people who know what's going on and allow and make space and time for them to be able to be part of the conversation.
Leanne, I've probably got about 3 minutes before I get forcibly removed from my chair. And I want to ask you my final question before we let you go is you ascribe a process where after we arrest the present and stop and acknowledge that this is, you know, cannot continue, we need to sort of step into the future and start projecting and discussing potential futures.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that we shouldn't get stuck in a politics of shutdown and get stuck in the second phase. Definitely. So how do we make that transition of saying we've arrested the present, we've shut down?
Yeah.
How do we start moving to stepping into the future? How do we get that part right?
These are big questions. You're giving me 3 minutes. So the first thing is to recognize that there have been a number of attempts, at least at WITS. Okay. And WITS is not the center of everything. It's only my experience. There's been at the university currently known as Rhodes and other places, mediation processes, dialogue processes that have happened. But what we often find is, this is my personal opinion, we often find that when we get close to a potential negotiation spot, there is a space where from the student side, not only from the student side, from both sides, big men want to step in.
Oh, yeah.
And steer the course in a different direction because their politics is one of big man politics. And when you have big man politics, even a solution, a democratic solution reached through consensus becomes not appropriate. And so the claim from Fees Must Fall at WITS is that our vice chancellor, they were negotiating and agreeing on something, and half an hour before they were going to come back from reporting back, it was live in the media. Okay. And that was what broke down the process. In another way, on the other side, you get to a point and maybe a student leader decides, no, I want to do something else. And so for me, the processes that allow, if we keep representative democracy, which I think is a flawed, we need to be more creative than that. We need to clarify the processes of communication between those elected leaders and people, and we need to pronounce that. Time and energy must be spent on the process of feedback as opposed to secret meetings, which is where most negotiations get. So students have said they don't want secret meetings. We will need a new form, and maybe the Imbizo isn't the form, but it at least cracks open this idea that a few men are going to sit in a room and resolve the issue. It's not going to happen.
Leanne, thank you so much. I'm sorry to rush you in that conclusion.
No,
I hope we get to have you on again.
No problem.
Someone we can learn so much from, and I'm not afraid to say definitely a national treasure for all of us.
Thank you.
Leanne Naidoo, thank you so much. It is the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We'll make sure to share the podcast, and you can download it as usual and share it far and wide. Thank you.
CliffCentral.com.